Welcome to the podcast.
I'm Ross, and I'm very excited today.
Yeah, and I'm Phil, and I'm
Just
also very
saying.
excited today. Just saying. And look, welcome. We've been teasing this podcast for a while, probably back to the tail end of last year. But the day is finally here, and we are very honored to be joined by Doug Campbell on this edition of the podcast. Good morning, good evening, wherever we are. Hello. Hello, Doug.
Hello. Yeah, bonjour from California. How are you?
And anyone that listens to the podcast on a semi-regular basis will know that we have been we've talked about Doug's movies quite a lot, and we'll loop back to where it all began for me and Ross with what still remains our favorite of all your films, Doug, which is Deadly Mile High Club.
Well, I'm honored that you guys have watched them and that you know them. So that's very, very nice because we make these movies in a wonderful vacuum and we have no idea who sees them. Because you make them and then you have an air date and that's it. And I'm not even, honestly, I'm not even told when the film airs. I have to find out from
Whoa.
the actors.
Wow.
I have I got two films show coming up on the 15th and the 17th of this month. One's called The Beach House Murders and the other's called She's Obsessed With My Husband. And I literally had to find out. I had to find out about the airings, through the grapevine, not necessarily from any official source. And we never hear who sees them or what the response is or whatever. We just make them, put them out. Next movie, make them, put them out. There's no more screenings where you sit there, Ross, with a group of wonderful people who see your movie and applaud and laugh and, come up to you afterward and wipe the tears out of their eyes and say, thank you for that. We don't get any of that. So to hear that you guys have actually seen them and can remember a title, I am completely beyond joyful
Oh,
right now. Thank you.
Doug, let me just quickly say, I was saying to Phil earlier, I went back to where it all began for us, which is Deadly Mile High Club. I know obviously that's not your first movie, but it was the first one. And I literally just got to the scene where Diane Robin is ejected from a plane at great height. And it follows one of my favorite scenes of the movie. Which, I mean, this is a crazy place to start, but screw everything. There's a moment when she's having an argument with the lead actress, basically telling her to stay away from the son-in-law, which is a great dialogue, really enjoyable and high energy. And there's this great bit where she walks up to her, and they're opposite each other across the wing of the plane. And then she has to do this thing where she has to walk around the entire wing of the plane to get to her to continue the scene. And I have to ask immediately, did she like was it blocked that way before shooting? Was it a, I'm not, I don't mean this facetiously, I'm genuinely curious, because the way she carries herself as she walks around the wing makes it just seem perfectly natural, perfectly normal within the confines of the argument, if you like. But I think any of us who shoot or do, movie making, any description, would find that, dare I say, kind of an awkward blocking. It's quite a, and she has to fill that space in the way she walks around that wing, and she does it effortlessly, in my
And she does it.
opinion,
And she, yes.
effortlessly, and it looks great. But at the same time, when you watch it with your analytical brain, you're going, "That's crazy! Like that's a
Exactly.
crazy thing in a movie."
No,
Can I just ask
you're
about that before we go into
apt.
anything else?
Sure. And a fellow filmmakers that you guys understand this kind of stuff. Sometimes I'll watch blocking in movies and I'll go, nobody stands that way. Nobody walks that way. That's hogwash, Well, here was the thing. First of all, kudos to the cast, Mark Herman, Allison McAtee, Diane Robin, Anna Marie Dobbins. What a wonderful bunch. And I love all those actors. And Diane is the second movie I've done with Diane. And she can fill any space anywhere, honey. Let me tell you something. She walk in this door right now and she'll tell you
Sweet.
what life is like. She will fill any space. She's an actor's actor and she's just a joy. But here was the situation. We don't have any money to make these movies. Okay. Well, they're made
Preach,
for a
we
huge.
remember that.
Trust me.
You guys
Yeah, we
know
know.
that. You guys know the drill. So it's like, okay, what's the movie about? It's about airplanes. So, Doug, get the airplanes, I told myself, in the goddamn movie. So, if we're going to have a conversation at an airport at night, let's do it around an airplane. So we did that, and David Dolnick, our wonderful cinematographer, figured out a way to light it from above as if there was a light up there somewhere. and we managed to pull that off. And then, yeah, just she's cleaning the plane, and the mom shows up, and that's just where she enters. And I made the terrible assumption that the audience will just go with it. And obviously, Ross, you didn't. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, I made the assumption that, you know, okay, she just appears from there. And then, how about this? Can this work for you? And she goes, oh, honey, I can fill that space. No problem. So it depends on the actor. And she's the kind of person that can do anything. And a theater-trained actor and not afraid to be large and do whatever she needs to do. Large as far as performance in any spots. And so that was fun. And thank you for remembering that. And I know exactly which scene you're talking about. And here's the ironic thing. Allison and Diane hit it off like gangbusters. They became the best of buds. So when she had to toss her out of the plane, I'm thinking, oh, the irony there, you know.
Oh, so, the plane, the plane tossing scene is it's weird because we probably came to the movie slightly ironically. Now, Ross has always had a love of Lifetime movies. At Christmas, all he watches is bloody films with people leaning against other people.
Like this, the actor and the actress going, hey.
Yeah, literally that. Every Christmas Ross puts at Christmas, but every film he watches is a Hallmark or a Lifetime Christmas movie.
That's funny.
Which I'm sure Ross would like to see your flavour of filmmaking at Christmas. I think that's a missed opportunity.
Right? I haven't seen a Christmas movie on your. I might be wrong, like on the IMDb.
No, you're right. I have yet to do one, and it's not because I'm an atheist. I would love to do a Christmas movie. No, I'd love to do a Christmas film. In fact, my producer and I are working on Nikki Layson and I are working on a Christmas idea at the moment, and it's kind of unusual, and we're excited about it. I'm not allowed to talk about it just yet, but we're working on that, and we're someday. Now, my type of Christmas movie, to be fair, is Bad Santa or It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh,
so
for sure.
I'm all about putting a story in these things, and oftentimes the Christmas movies that are made for Hallmark, no offense to the good people at Hallmark out there, but they know this. Isn't any conflict.
Yeah.
I would describe them as frictionless.
Exactly. Yes. But you know what? That's their mission. And if they were to hire me, God bless them if they do, and I hope they do. I'm actually pushing to get a job over there right now. Cool. If they hire me, I will make a frictionless movie with so much grease that no one will be frictioned. It'll be fantastic.
You know, so. Teflon Christmas movie.
We can do it. Can do. But deep down, I'm a drama guy. I'm a conflict guy. And I like story. So, you know, but if I have to do one without, well, okay. We'll do it, you know.
It's interesting because, we probably came to Deadly Mile High Club slightly with a ironic, is like a Lifetime movie.
It's going to be ridiculous.
It'll be ridiculous. But generally, there's... What we tend to find, and what me and Ross talk about a lot on the podcast and in real life, is how you can have like $100 million movie. And we've just been through this with Argyle, right? You know, our last podcast that will come out, that'll be out by the time this airs. It's needless to say, we were not a fan. We were not a fan of Argyle because it's just, you know, it's a lot of money.
You didn't like Argyle?
No, Argyle.
Okay, I've
got
to see it.
Love Argyle. Great.
Argo's fantastic. Yeah.
So we often watch these big budget movies and go, there's no joy, there's no fun, there's no entertainment. It's just, and it, we watch like you get to like Deadly Mile High Club, and it was on the back of Ross giving me another film to watch. Ross, was it 97 minutes or something?
57 minutes, I think.
Yeah, and some other plane movie, and we watched it, and like me and Russell immediately we were kind of obsessed with it, and we were like, this is just so entertaining as a movie, and then that led us into other things. It was really, really exciting to kind of find Deadly Mile High Club and then everything else that's preceded it.
Well, thank you for watching that, and that there's lots of things in that movie I would like to change, and there's lots of ridiculous things in it as well. For instance, we went to, first of all, you're making a movie with no budget, right? Again. Okay. So we got to do a plane sequence at the end. And the executive producer, Tim, said, guys, don't get so serious about the logistics of it. Just do it and they'll go with it. Cause you know, okay. All right. So now she's going to fly a Gulfstream or a Learjet at the end. Okay, great. Where are we going to get a Learjet? So we went to this place and they had a Learjet interior. Okay, but the door they had from a 737 and the cockpit they had from a 747. And you so cut them all.
It's a jigsaw plane.
And so
a cut and chuck plane, as we tell
you. You have to cobble it together. So when she, you know, when the people go up to open up that door, the doors don't open up that way on a plane. On a Learjet, there's a door that folds out and down. You know, this one swings out like a regular.
That's great.
And we just thought, you know, if the actors believe it, and the editor believes it, and the composer believes that we're going to get away with it. And also this thing's a little bit tongue in cheek, especially when the guy's about to throw his wife out the door.
Yeah.
We're talking about,
I love amazing.
What they did with those actors, wonderful Mark and Allison did with the dialogue, of which I'll take credit for because I wrote it, but they did a wonderful job with that humorous dialogue about, yeah, the shark food. Oh, I bet they're going to love this. And he's about to toss his wife out. You know, so stuff like that's a lot of fun to do. And I appreciate you watching it. And there actually is a little Deadly Mile High Club group, I heard. Oh, and Gonzo Rogers, Damon Sperber, he was fun in that too. The guy who crashes the bike.
I love my. He goes, I love my life. Also, just before. He
yeah, I love being me. Now that was his line. I love being me.
Right. I love being me. That's it. I love being me. It's so good. Right. That sequence is so funny. Still,
it's great. Yeah,
when you've got his one of his two lady. I don't know, like customer attractors, whatever you want to call those guys, ladies in the cabin crew. The assistants. And she's kind of going something about the safety and then just in the background, the plane crashes. I was surprised that it didn't actually have a massive fireball coming up from behind the hangar. But you know exactly what's happened.
You know what it is. Yeah. And Zephanie Adoko, that's Zephanie. She's one of my former students from Academy of Art. And anyway, she's terrific. Yeah.
It's great. Yeah. Let's do some of the basic questions for people who may not.
Before you get too far away from it, I've come up with two titles for your Christmas movie, Doug.
And, okay, you know, I'm writing it down.
So I'm going either with Elf Who's Stalking.
What? Elf?
Elf Who's Stalking. Because you were there, Look Who's Stalking. So Elf Who's
Stalking. Okay.
But my favorite one is Deadly Elf Conspiracy.
Ooh, there you go.
What about Stalked by Santa?
Stalked by Santa. Yeah, that's good.
Santa Stalker.
I like that.
Yeah, all good titles.
It's fun.
Deadly Claws.
Deadly Claws. Oh, that's
let's
a good
some,
one too.
For people, certainly for people who don't know, let's do some of the, dare I say, some of the more basic, and we'll spin off into other tangents. But so, Doug, for everybody, including us, actually, how did you get into the industry as a director? As much or as little as you want to tell us.
Okay. Well, thank you for asking. That's a great question. And when people have asked me that question, I realize, or when students ask me that question, I realize the answer is when I fell in love with it. Because I think you're in it. This is my personal 22 cents on the matter. I think you're in the film business when you say to yourself, I love doing this. This is fun, right? And I started saying that as a kid. So I started saying that when I was like 10. And then that begat literally making Super 8s when I was 14. You know, at 10, I was doing sketches with my friends in class. And at 14, I was doing little Super 8s. And then 10 years later, I was lucky enough to find myself on a film set with Aeroflex cameras and a cast and everything. And on 30-day schedule and the whole deal, full crew, everything. And I was very, very blessed to be going out with a project at age 23 with my partner, Scott Mulvaney and Dan Salakovic. And we went out with a trailer and we went out with a screenplay and we went out with a prospectus with all the people that we wanted on the crew, our friends from California Institute of the Arts, CalArts. And we were just praying for somebody to like it. And lo and behold, the day after I typed the end on the typewriter, Scott found a couple of guys who wanted to raise money for films for this new thing called video, the video stores, to fill product on the video stores. And we luckily got a group of guys. They were called GCO Pictures. And they raised money for my first feature film. And God bless these guys. They went to work and they did the best thing that could have ever happened to me. And there I was at a very young age with all the tools and all the time and all the money that I could have ever asked for. And I didn't make a very good movie. I made
Was that an American murder?
It's American movie, American Murder. Now,
great cast though.
Great cast. Sharon Bialy was our casting director. Great cast. Love the cast. Ray Wise, Michael Bowen.
Ray Wise is terrific.
Clancy Brown as well.
Clancy Brown. I know. Claire Wren. A great cast. But the director writer, yours truly, and admittedly so, didn't write a screenplay with enough open conflict. It was boring. It was boring. And we weren't making an art film. We were making a thriller. Fast forward to 15 years later, I'm in Tokyo talking to my friend John, and John goes, "Oh, I saw that film when it came to Tokyo and screened in the theaters." He goes, "I love the slow European feel. I love the mood that you created." I said, "John, I was trying to make a thriller and I blew it." You know? And I tell that story to my students because it's like, don't underestimate the power of the pen when you're writing that screenplay, and slash out boring dialogue and keep the action moving and keep the conflict going. So after that, I went through a little bit of a nervous breakdown at age 25. And what the hell did I do wrong? So I read everything I could on screenwriting. I read every script I could, and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. And I taught myself how to write a tight, conflict-filled screenplay with structure, with character, with arc. And now I can do that with pretty much anything that you throw at me. And I don't have an agent, so I'm doing it, telling you what I can do. So that was my journey to getting my first film. But after that, I was out of work and back at the restaurant business. And a lovely guy by the name of Jeff Burr, who recently passed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeff called me up. I was at my dad's house. He said, "Hey, Doug, this is Jeff Burr. And the guys over at ITC saw a couple reels of your film. And because the cinematographer is auditioning for a job, and they really liked your film, you should go talk to them." So thanks to Jeff, I did. And lo and behold, I got a teen comedy after that. Well, you know, how my brooding American murder, father-son mystery movie, erotic thriller, had anything to do with me getting a teen comedy about a guy who popped bras with telekinesis. I don't know how that connection happened.
Sorry, that I have to say that already sounds like the best film ever.
Oh, no, no.
Zapped again.
It's got a little cult following out there, and it's really silly and it's funny and it's fun. But, you know, anyways, so the business is up and down, and you never know if you're going to work again. The last time I was on a podcast, I said I was going to write and direct a movie, and then I got pulled from it. So I'm going to say in this podcast, nothing's on the books this year, which, if it's reverse psychology, then I'll be working like really quickly. So the business is up and it's down. It's up and down, as you guys know. And I just stay at it no matter what. I'm insane, and I can't do anything else very, very well. So I teach in between and I make films. Last year I made five, directed five. The year before I directed six. The year before I directed four. And we'll hope this little gravy train keeps going. And they're small, they're fun to make, and I get to make them with my buddies. And they're a lot of fun to make without the stress of a bigger budget and the problems that go along with that. So
I was just gonna say that's one thing that definitely comes across, right? Like the films are always, no matter what the theme, there's always a feeling of kind of, I don't know, they just feel like they were quite fun to make, and like you would have enjoyed.
There's good energy in them.
Yeah, there's good energy. Absolutely that, right? Like you kind of go, because like I went from, I think we did Deadly Mile High Club, and I think my next one of yours was Deadly Garage Sale, which I have to say, just on title alone, I was in. I was like, that just sounds like the best title ever. And that's, again, it's like another great kind of, it's a film that doesn't, that entertains, it doesn't challenge, it breezes past in the best way possible. And you watch it and you go, "Hey, that was really good fun." And then you know, it's kind of, and I love that about it. And I kind of, you know, I think Ross, you were the same. What was your second one, Ross? Where did you follow Deadly Mile High Club with?
To remember the order would be
insane.
Trying to remember that.
I'm chagrined.
It might have actually been the same. actually. I don't know, roughly. But I was it's funny getting on to what you were saying about how many movies you've shot over the last few years.
Yeah.
One of my, again, fairly basic questions was, how long do you normally have in terms of developing, shooting, and in post with your movies? I know that obviously they can vary.
They
but it
vary,
feels like
sure.
there's a it feels like there's a certain level. In the last few years, it feels like they're
Sure.
all of give or take a particular level, if that means.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. Well, first of all, post is fairly solid at 4 months-ish of a delivery. Developing, okay, it all depends on the state of the idea when it lands on my desktop or I'm asked to write it. Sometimes it's months and months and months, and sometimes it's quick, we need that like yesterday. So the development of it can vary big time as far as the writing of it goes. The pre-production, because it's low budget, people have to work other jobs, so you don't get your crew, your production designer, your casting director, your costume designer until a couple weeks. Well, casting director earlier than that, but you don't get your crew until a couple weeks before the show. So pre-production's fast. Pre-production is like a month, and then we'll shoot them in a good 14-day schedule, and we'll run two cameras, and that helps it. That turns 14 days into like 21-ish feel, because you can get the over the shoulder and the close up at the same time, and you only have to get it right once, which is a help. It beats making films on film, frankly. And so shoot them in 14 days, and then our editor will probably have a first cut in 3 to 4 weeks ish after that, and then I'll probably sit with him or her for a good 6-day period for my director's cut, and then EP notes can take a week, maybe two, depending, and we'll deal with it, and then we'll lock the picture soon after that, and then we get into post. Now, one film that I did last year, Vanished in Yosemite, by the way, that script came to us, and it was a big action picture in the snow. It was like Vertical Limit. And I said, guys, we can't do this. This is impossible. So the script was shelved, but there was an air date. Still, this was in February. We had an air date in August, and it was like the script was shelved.
Wow.
So there was nothing.
Ow.
There was blank white page, nothing. And I got on the phone with the executive producer. He said, listen, we got to make a movie in Yosemite because we're doing the National Park series. So Doug, can you write a movie that takes place in Yosemite that's a thriller that isn't weather dependent? And I looked up and I went, yeah. And 3 weeks later, we had the screenplay. And 2 weeks after that, we were shooting it. That fast. The casting went like this. We went out to the leads. Right. But then I called up the casting director and I said, see if John Burdell is available to play the mayor. See if Shamika Wright is available to play the hotel person. See if Devontae Winfrey is available to play the cop. Because we've worked with them before. We know they're great people. And we know they can handle it. Mackenzie Posage, can she play blank? And we just made these offers and they said, yes, yes, yes. And that's how we booked the cast. And that was nice to do it that way, because it was like bringing the rep theater company that you know that you've worked with before, because we didn't have any time. We didn't have any time
to go.
Sam.
Sam Raimi is a good example of that, isn't he? In terms of his stop play. I mean, maybe not so much now with the massive movies, but certainly back in the day when he was doing smaller and probably better movies, quite frankly. Sam Raimi had his kind of stock cast of people. Obviously, Bruce Campbell is the most famous one of them.
And
it makes a lot of sense. If you know that people can do the job and you have a good time and they know the deal, meaning not just money, but like, the circumstances of the shoot.
Right. Correct.
You're going to get you're going to deliver so much quicker. For people listening who don't know how that works.
I'm a fan of auditions because, you might think that person might be perfect for it, but they may not be. And they may read it and go, no, that's not the thing. That's not the guy. So, but this was like, there was no time. It was like, we got to go. We got to get on the road. We got to drive up to Yosemite and shoot the movie. So sometimes it's that fast. And by the way, we made the air date.
Wow.
And it was like, boom.
That's what counts.
I haven't got around to watching it yet. I've got it queued up. I'm going away this week.
You.
It's one of the ones I've been watching this week. But I have to say, one of the things I loved about it, just from the IMDb description, was IMDb description is, while vacationing, I'll get my teeth in Yosemite, Sisters Katrina and Jennifer meet the perfect guy, Handsome Rick.
Rick.
I hope that's his name. That better be his actual name.
I actually scrolled down into the credits and go, please tell me his name in there. And he actually, in the film, he actually Handsome introduces Rick. Himself as Hi, I'm Handsome Rick.
No, he doesn't, but he should. But he should.
He should. So I'm sure Ross has some more kind of the basic questions. But one thing I did want to make sure we talk about, and probably a bit more length, because, like, there was one of your films that absolutely blew us away for a completely different reason. And so we watched, and again, I'm using the IMDb titles. I know sometimes they might be different, but we watched Cheerleader Conspiracy.
Yeah, which now that's called Deadly Cheer Mom.
Deadly Cheer Mom. Yeah.
Deadly right. Cheer Mom. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. Which is a right. much better title. Right. So we love right. Deadly Cheer Mom. Right. But what blew us away was, because obviously these movies have a certain structure and a certain expectation of how the films are going to play out and end. And we both watched it and we kind of messaged each other afterwards and we were like, the ending.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Can I just say the ending is like, forget M. Night Shyamalan. You could not predict from the beginning of the movie how that movie ends.
Oh,
you
good.
You could never predict it. You were like, what the?
It took us, it really took us back because it was like, for the kind of like that kind of Lifetime type movie, like they're normally quite traditional in their, you know, good guy, you know, challenge.
The moral, perhaps we should say moral compass, possibly.
The moral that's right. compass,
that's
yeah,
right.
yeah, yeah.
That's right, that's right. Well,
and then you threw this in with an ending that was just, literally just was like, holy shit.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll speak to that. And that's ironically what happened was, first of all, that wasn't a Lifetime film.
Oh,
that was for Tubi. That was for Tubi.
Oh, yes, some of them. I've got to say, there's been a bit of a crossover in terms of these platforms for us, because when we say Lifetime movie, we don't necessarily mean the Lifetime channel. We just mean that kind of...
It's now its own genre. It's kind of becoming its own thing.
I refer to it as a genre. Yeah, yeah. Right. That's exactly it. Yeah, yeah.
I want it to become a verb. Like, I Lifetimed the guys. Like, I clocked them overhead with a candlestick.
Boy, that was a real hallmark. You know.
Yeah, there, there you go. Yeah. No, what happened was this. My good friend, and she's wonderful, Marianne Wunsch, called me in to work on that, to direct that. And the script was in flux, and they were making it. It was Mar Vista, and they were making it for Tubi. Okay, and the dictum, the orders from on high from Tubi were, we don't want a Lifetime film. And I thought, well, you're doing a movie about a mother daughter, and it's a cheerleader thing. And the producer was Lance Robbins, who's a wonderful guy. I love him. And anyway, so okay, we got to work on the screenplay. We got to fix it. And so I came in to work on the script, and I don't remember the original problems, but there were some original problems that I dealt with, and I wrote three versions for them very, very quickly. They were polishes; they weren't full page one rewrites. But I did three versions of them. I did the safe version, where, you know, the good guy, the good girl is absolved of her crimes, and the bad girl goes to prison. I did the one that was sort of a mixture in between. And then I did the one where I said, they're never going to go for this. This is hardcore noir. I'm sending that girl to jail. And the good guys are going to get away with it. And they're going to be in the hot tub at the end. And they're going to be toasting their victory. They're not going to go for this. And they went for it.
It's amazing. I gave them the
ending that I thought nobody on earth is going to like this ending. And they did. And they went for it. And that's what we shot.
I have to say, there's a comparison there, which is going to sound like a strange comparison. Did you ever see the original ending to Dodgeball? The Ben Stiller movie?
No.
The original ending. I mean, I love Dodgeball. I love how it plays out. I love a bit of Chuck Norris at the end. The original ending to Dodgeball, which is on the DVD, at least in the UK, is when Wit does that last point, and then they say his foot was over the line or whatever it is, and they have to do the sudden death thing. No, it was just a legal move. And they win, and he's held up in slow motion like Rudy, yeah?
Yeah.
And that's the end. The bad guys win, the good guys lose. That's the end. And it just cuts to black, and you go,
oh, wow.
What the fuck? If you'd seen that in the cinema, you'd have been like,
yeah,
what? I mean, I love how it plays out. I love how it plays out in the full version.
Yeah.
But can you imagine if you see that movie, and the little guy loses, the big guy kids,
Yeah.
and their dreams are destroyed. I'm like,
Yeah.
oh my
Yeah.
God.
I
So
learned that
anyway,
lesson. Go ahead.
so all I was going to say is the way that Cheerleader Conspiracy or Deadly Cheer Mom, one
Yeah.
of the problems with the title Deadly Cheer Mom is there's no Deadly Cheer Mom, just as a spoiler.
And
She's not actually deadly, not deadly, you know. But anyway, but
it's a
one of the things,
whodunit. It's a whodunit. So
it
why
is a
call out?
whodunit.
I know. So why
I love
call
that.
out the culprit in the title?
Yeah,
Anyway, whatever.
why do
But
it?
was
And
I don't
also,
title
when we
them. I
found,
don't title
no, when we found out who the person was, when you see the CCTV,
them.
Phil and I were both like, what? Why is it
Yeah.
her? What? That was because there's such a
Yeah.
red herring situation going on with
Yeah.
the other mom. And anyway,
Yeah.
there's a one of the things that the ending reminded me of, as is, it's almost like you say, noir, like noir films of the
Yeah.
40s and 50s, where
Yeah.
a bit like, I mean, Double Indemnity is probably too specific, but the
Yeah.
fact that, like, essentially, the good guy is in prison,
He's
essentially.
in prison. Yeah.
And for kind of, now here's, I just want to bounce off a couple of questions off you. The first one is, there's a bit of trivia on IMDb that says that the deep fake situation was something based on that happened to you in real life. Is that nonsense or is that real?
Happened to me?
That's what it, there's a trivia on IMDb. If you
Really?
look up the IMDb page, it says, director, I can't remember
Yes,
exactly, you
the
might be
director
good.
Doug
Yeah,
Campbell was
there
inspired
you
to
go.
make this film after he was a victim of deep fake technology.
I assume
Absolute
that bullshit.
was.
I've never been deep fake, nor that not that I know of. And who would want to deep fake me? What do you think? What do
Well, you'd be
you know,
surprised.
deep
Actually,
fake?
Doug, you'd be surprised. People, there are
Yeah.
people out there who do very strange shit.
Oh,
So that, okay, that's cool.
I think you
Oh,
might have just
sorry.
I think you just might have set a competition for people now.
Who would want
Yeah,
to do it? Oh, good
that would be a,
Lord.
that would be
I hope
absolutely
not.
amazing. Just quickly, then, I want to bounce a more general question off to you for the films. Now, obviously, you don't necessarily write all of them, as you've just mentioned, but you're obviously fairly heavily involved, and certainly as a director, you know, in terms of creatively. One of the things that I have felt, having watched, I haven't watched all of them, but I've watched a significant number of your movies, is, let me just, I'm just trying to figure out how I've phrased it. Right, okay, so I feel that a lot of your supposed villains in your movies, the characters who are essentially the antagonist or are at least framed as what you would call the villain of a typical genre movie, are actually, in my opinion, victims. Not always, but a significant number of them are in some ways victims. And a lot of who we normally think of as, say, the good guys. And with a lot of the female-led movies, I know your movies aren't really horror movies, but you sometimes refer to them as, say, the final girl, like essentially the lead girl, right, who goes through a lot of suffering. I feel like a lot of those characters, the perceived good guys, kind of deserve their punishment from the villains. Cheerleader Conspiracy is a
Great
really good
observation.
example. And again, I really want to ask. Thank you. And I was about to ask, is that on purpose? Like, is it something that you specifically have a bent towards in your philosophy? I'm not trying to be too
Yeah.
wanky here, if
No.
you pardon my words. I mean, is it something where you kind of so again, Sam Raimi, I'm not particularly referencing Sam Raimi for any reason, but he had this whole thing that he says the good must suffer, the innocent must suffer. So, and I'm just wondering if there's anything like that in the way that you write or the way that you, and I appreciate, I'm assuming a lot of these films are sort of essentially commissioned from you to sort of say, we need a movie about it. I'm guessing
That's
anyway.
right. That's right.
Could
That's
you
right.
sort of like tell us a little bit about
Sure.
that, how that maybe how that commissioning works with you, and then if this is a sort of a philosophy might be the wrong word, but is this an aspect of the writing that you do actually put into it, or is it
Yeah.
something that perhaps is asked of you?
Yeah. Okay, great. First of all, how the films will come to me is an executive producer will say, "Hey, Doug, send me some pitches." And I'll send in, I don't know, 15 pitches. And then they'll come back and they'll go, "Okay, we like two of them. Develop these into one pagers." And then, "Okay, we like this one. Let's go forward with this one." Or they'll come to me with a pitch that's a one pager or a paragraph or an idea like Deadly Garage Sale was a phone call where Tim Johnson said, "Hey, Doug, let's make a movie about Deadly Garage Sale Killer." And I went, "Well, what?" And he said,
Yeah,
"Yeah,
but
yeah."
great.
And that was his idea. And then I started to write it, by the way. And then he called back after I was on page 18 of the, and he goes, "Stop writing it." He goes, "They don't have garage sales in Europe." And I went, okay. And then a couple years later, he said, why don't you do the garage sale film? So we did it anyway. So that's how they'll come to me in different forms. Sometimes they're completed screenplays, and rarely, honestly, does a screenplay land in my lap that I go, I would love to direct this. The one that I did love to direct was called Her Bodyguard. And that was the film that I was fired off of for being male.
Oh,
I'm not kidding you.
How long ago was that? If you don't mind me asking. It was about
2 years ago. Let's put it this way. I was replaced by a female director, and she's lovely and talented. And I think the world of her, and I can't wait to meet her. Her name's Lindsay. Anyway, so, you know, no bitterness there, but I really, really loved that script, and I got to do a polish on it, and I was raring to go. So every once in a while, a script lands that's like, okay, this is really good. And then most of the time, it's, here's the idea, work, either you write it or work with this writer to put it together. So that's how that happens. But then you were asking about, what was the other question about?
It's kind of like,
the villain. Okay, so I don't have a moral or a theme or anything like that I'm trying to sell. What I do very simply is I do what I learned a long time ago from my teacher, Alexander McKendrick, and my screenwriting teacher, Gil Dennis, was I sit down at the beginning of any show and I interview my characters, and I have a long list of questions, and I say, you know, what do you want? Why do you want it? What are life or death stakes? If I don't get blank, then blank will happen and it will be the death of blank. What are the forces that are driving me as a character to pursue my goals? How do I arc? How do you arc? I ask the character sitting next to me in the imaginary empty chair. And they answer me. They talk back to me. And I go crazy. And my wife goes, who the hell are you talking to? You go, shut up, honey. I'm writing. So
now on that point, sorry to interject.
Yeah.
I was literally about to specifically mention Albert Beck.
Yeah. He's a product of that. Thank you for watching that. Yes, you're right. Laid back Beck. That was his character title. Character name.
When I told Phil that in part three there are two Erin Crofts.
Yeah.
I was like, I love. So I've only met Eric once. Personal note. Got with him really well. I asked him loads of. He was so giving of his time, cheeky in a good way and all that sort of stuff. I'm a big fan of the best of the best film franchise.
Sure.
He's in the first two parts, but not in the second two parts. And when he told me why, that was fantastic. So,
I'll tell you, some of the action in the films that you made, I mean, my gosh, fantastic. And that's the world of that. You know, you're kicking ass in there. Yeah.
Oh my God. Thank you so much for saying that.
Yeah, no, Ross, you know what you're doing.
World.
It's true. It's very talented. back to the villain is when you ask a villain, I don't look at these people as bad people. I look at these people as people and their characters. Why do you need to destroy this person's life? Well, they did blank to me, and it's got to be justified. And then I have to do the same thing with the good guy, the main character, the good gal. And if it's an obsession story or a revenge story, it doesn't matter. I get to the heart of why the character's doing what they're doing. And it sort of just balances out that way, where I feel that the villain has to have a good reason for doing what they're doing. And you should say, in my opinion, I think you should say when you watch these films, you should go, you know what? If I was in their shoes, I might do that myself. I might do that myself. And that to me is the fun of it, because a lot of them are carried through the villain's point of view. And it's like, hey, audience, come with us on this journey and be wronged like this person and feel like this person. Now let's watch this person take revenge. Now, how do you feel about it? How do you feel about it? And that's the fun part. You're writing the back and forth. If I were to have a villain who's twirling their mustache and going, I'm the bad guy and I'm just evil, I'm not going to believe that character personally. Because I think everybody's got their reason for doing it. Even genocidal maniacs like Adolf Hitler, if you do any research on who he was as a child and what he went through, you go, okay, I get the psychology. It's crazy. It's sick. It's wrong. But as a character, he was abused by his father and he grew up completely mentally messed up. Okay. All right. Now we understand this character. So I try to understand the villains, you know, don't necessarily love them, but you sympathize with them and understand where they're coming from. So that's why that happens.
This is interesting to me because I suppose there's, first of all, we can say no one's really the villain in their own story, right? We're all the hero of our own narrative without getting, again, too into writing theory and stuff. But it interests me because Albert Beck, maybe it's because Eric Roberts is very charming, even when he's going kind of crazy on screen, I mean, as in doing things that you would consider, you know, unfair or whatever, you know, or evil or whatever. But I think of Albert Beck as being unlucky in love. And so, for real, like as far as he goes and as too far as he goes, the way he seems to, at least to the audience, logic out what he's doing and why he's doing it.
Right.
I'm not saying we agree, but you can, there is definitely, at least in my opinion, I think there is a clear through line as to how he behaves. And applying that to, and again, I'll use the word loosely, the villains of the other movies.
Yeah.
When you see how, again, the characters who are sort of supposed to be the heroes, and I'm using that word loosely, in most genre movies, are, it's interesting to me how a lot of them. So, okay, Deadly Mile High Club, the lead actor, I apologize, Mark Herman, who's great, but he's clearly, at least as he's portrayed on screen, I don't think that he's stupid. But he seems to be, in some ways, easily led. He's super good looking. I mean, he's crazy good looking. My goodness.
I know.
But what I'm getting... Sorry, I know I'm probably being a bit... I'm not really phrasing this properly. But it's the fact... I guess what I'm saying is, in some movies, he'd almost be just like a himbo and that kind of thing.
A himbo, I love that.
I just mean as in... You know what I'm saying? That's what interpretation of who he is. But in this movie, it's like... it's. In Deadly Mile High Club, his character is kind of being pushed and pulled between like three very strong female characters: his wife, the mother-in-law, who's Diane Roberts, amazing, and of course the flight instructor who's obsessed with him. I don't want to call him oblivious, because I think oblivious is the wrong word. But he, so all I'm getting at is, in most movies, he would be the one who we are rooting for, or he and his wife. We should be rooting for he and his wife, and weirdly. Not by saying a psychotic woman should be able to kill the wife and get him and all that stuff, but I feel like we're on her side. We're on the side of who we would normally describe as antagonists.
Right.
More. We see more of their perspectives, and we see more of what they want and why they want it.
Right. Right.
I hope any of this is clear.
It is clear, and bless you for even noticing, because believe me, you hit it right on the head, Ross. That's exactly what these scripts are to me, is let's find out why that villain has to do what they do. And if we end up empathizing or sympathizing with that villain, great, absolutely. And in that movie, it's a simple story of obsession. She suffers Aristotle's undeserved misfortune, and she, you know, plane crash scene one, and she loses the man she loves. How can you not care for her, you know? Yeah. And then she finds the man that she thinks she's going to love again. And you know what? A strange part of us is rooting for her to find love again and for her to work out. So all these other people are obstacles to get in her way. And that she, of course, has to get rid of them in her psychotic, messed up way of doing it. So, yeah, thank you for that. I appreciate that, and you're absolutely right. You get an A on the paper. You analyzed it perfectly.
Ross gets his thesis on the movies of Doug Campbell.
Oh,
I love
my God.
That.
So, I'm honored. Yeah.
I found a great website, which is on tvtropes.org, which goes through your films and breaks down some of the tropes. I thought it'd be quite fun to, in our last kind of five-ish minutes, to go through some of this stuff.
Okay.
But I think you might like this. They describe you as, and I'll read this out verbatim, right, because I totally agree with this, along with fellow Lifetime author David DeCotto, Campbell has a flair for, has a fair claim for being the modern Roger Corman, with his quirky shot, no-budget films, revolving around lurid exploitation film plots, but also with a knack for black comedy and camp. I mean, what a great description, right? Like the modern day Roger Corman. Love that.
I read that article, and I'm trying not to let this get to my head, because it's going to get me. I can't fit through that door behind me right now. It's very nice of them to say that. I'm just trying to make a good. Right? Well, it's nice, but you know what? It's really weird. I'm just trying to tell a good story and understand these people as real people and believe and have the audience believe the situations that we're inventing. I'm not trying to do anything.
Which,
you know,
is what I'm comedy, not, right?
No, I'm not trying to do any of that. I'm just saying, okay, we got a story about blank.
Yeah.
Now, what are the players in that story? How can we make the story? I don't look at these as silly, trite movies. I look at them as we've got to make, it's a team effort, of course. We've got to make the best movie we can possibly do. And I don't look down on them.
No, rightly so.
We'll have a fun time with them. So,
and I think that's the same. That's where, for me, the Roger Corman thing really comes in, because that's how Corman made movies. Corman didn't look at it as a silly low-budget horror film or a silly low-budget comedy. Yeah. He looked at it as, here is a good script with the best cast. We go out, we make a fun movie in a short space of time. We don't spend too much money on it. We don't waste a second of that screen time. Right. And we pull out something at the end of it, which is lean, entertaining, and consumable in the best possible way. And I think what that's where, for me, that's where that kind of Roger Corman thing is a perfect allegory for what you're doing. Because I think Corman made those that's exactly the same way Corman approached filmmaking. And that's fun.
And also there's you're prolific in terms of, you know, just quickly, a couple of quick things then, if we haven't got too much more time. But first, I've got one question, then I've got a list of pitches for you, Doug, just in terms of, because we talked about that a little bit earlier.
Okay.
Just purely because, you know, because my brain.
As if I have the power to put anything into production, I don't. I'm a hired guy. But anyway,
you just might like the ideas. It's more of a ingesting.
You can steal them.
Yeah, trust me. These are great. Right, but the first, probably my last question in terms of as a writer and as a filmmaker, are all or most of the Doug Campbell movies connected as some sort of part of the DCEU? The Doug Campbell extended universe, because Sleepwalking in Suburbia, and I don't think you did the fourth Stalked by My Doctor, but that is a crossover. But it is a crossover.
Yeah. Oh, I wrote the first draft.
Oh, you did.
The second draft. And then another director took it over. But yeah, that was a crossover movie. That was not me. That was the executive producer Tim Johnson, who is very, very creative and very wonderful guy. He said, hey, I've got this movie Sleepwalking in Suburbia. I've also got Stalked by My Doctor. What if she goes and sees him? The challenge was, though, Sleepwalking in Suburbia, the first one was SAG and the other one was non-SAG.
Now
we got to blend those worlds. So that's what that's what happened there. And by that time, I was done with the Stalked by My Doctor franchise for reasons I will not say on a podcast.
And by the way, I love the idea that they might be connected. We often reference the Doug Campbell extended universe. So in our mind, if nothing else, in my mind, I just see that there's a cop running about LA trying to solve
all of these insane crimes.
You know what's funny? Is we just did a movie where we booked the same actor CJ Hammond to play a cop in one film, and then we booked him again, and I said, we got to do that, and we gave him a line that he references on the phone to the other film to try to connect the universes, but I had to cut it out. I had to cut out that line. But if anybody's paying attention, and by the way, one name that needs to be mentioned here, well, two names, Ken Sanders and Robert Ballo. Ken Sanders produced a lot of these earlier films with me, and he was the one who brought me back in there. He was a very, very creative driving force on some of the films that you're talking about, and happy to acknowledge his contribution. You know, very talented guy and a heck of a producer, as is Robert. You know, and so I work with some really great people, and my executive producers are brave people who take risks. And my job is to make the best movie I can for these guys and gals, and hopefully they can make a profit so they can do more. So.
And long may you continue, because I have to say, like, certainly for us and other people that we've introduced to your films, like, the feedback has always been the same, where everyone's like, these are such entertaining films. I actually wish there was a better way to get them in the UK, because, like, the UK is not great for these. It can be, sometimes it's on a random TV station. Sometimes I have to use a VPN.
Amazon Prime. Some from on Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime, yeah. Sometimes they're like I was reading like through some of your, we were talking about this the other day, but I was desperate to see Wheels of Beauty because it just sounded like the best film ever, and we wanted to watch The Manny just because of the title. The Manny, yeah.
can't find the Manny anywhere.
It had me at hello.
So do you have two?
We've got about. Yeah, no, we don't in the UK. We have to do it.
Don't
via
get Tubi
VPN.
In the UK. Oh, bummer. Yeah. No. By the way, if Deadly Mile High Club and Driven to Kill have a lot in common.
Okay, I mean,
they're sister movies. They're sister movies.
Oh my god.
Okay, I'm definitely gonna have to work even harder.
Wait a minute. I see what they're doing. It's the same kind of thing they're doing over here. Anyway.
So Ross, we have two minutes left.
Yeah, I'm just gonna reel off. I've got like 10 titles. I just want yeses or noes from you. Okay, just going to go straight through them.
So the question is this a Doug Campbell movie or is this not a Doug Campbell movie? Yes,
I think Doug. I think Doug could probably make any of these into a movie. But
of course.
Okay, right. No particular order. Psychotic Dog Trainer.
Yes.
Perfect. Deadly Dentist.
Yes.
Deadly Flight Crew.
Yes.
The Wrong Quarterback.
Yes.
I'm just going to pitch in Stalked by My Dentist. I think that's a natural progression.
No, you could do all of them. I've picked specific ones. Stalked by My Karate Instructor, because I want to make one of these.
Yes.
Stalked by My Podiatrist.
Yeah.
Haunted, because I love Haunted by My Gynecologist.
Oh my gosh, yes. Of course.
Stalked by My Stunt Coordinator, because I'm amazed you haven't done a movie that I've seen where it's on a film set.
Yeah, sure. All of them are great. All of them are great.
A couple more. Two more. So I had this idea for group ones, not just individuals. So Stalkers Anonymous, where I think some of these stalking characters have to go to a group of like AA. Like stalked.
Oh, that's funny.
And then they all start, you know, kind of interacting. I think that could be
fun. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, yeah.
And then the Wrong Rehab or The Wrong Sponsor.
Ooh. So, all of these are good. All of these are
inspired
good.
By,
they're all good.
These were inspired. Thank you. That was actually inspired by Swim Instructor Nightmare, when we see the wife, she's actually in AA, which
she's
fantastic.
In AA. Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. And I thought, well, what if they're fucking with her?
Yeah.
You could really mess someone up if you're supposed Absolutely. To be their sponsor and you mess with their life.
Yeah.
Just saying.
No, these are all good. You should consider writing pitches to go with those.
don't encourage him, Doug.
Yeah, I'll be ready tomorrow. Doug, I'll be with you tomorrow. Oh my god!
I'm gonna be honest and say we could talk to you for hours. Right, this has been such fun, and you've been so gracious with your time, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Genuinely, we love what you're doing. We love the films, and like anytime we trace one down and we find it, we're like, right, we've got to watch this, and we'll talk about it on the next podcast. So,
I'm honored, and I shall watch your films as well. Let's not forget, you guys are terrific filmmakers yourselves, and I'd like to interview you if I had a podcast. But you guys are fantastic. Thank you.
So, just quickly, Doug. Before we, I mean, obviously, Phil, if there's anything else, but one thing we should ask you, Doug, of course, is there anything you want to plug? Any social medias? Any or anything coming up? And
I've got two movies that are airing on one on LMN, Lifetime Movie Network, and one on Lifetime Channel on the 15th. Is what the hell's the name of it? She's Obsessed with My Husband on Lifetime Movie Network. And then on the 17th is The Beach House Murders. And those are two films that we just finished. And then if anybody's interested, if you go to Vimeo Pro, you can download a movie that nobody's seen called The Hammer with Michael Madsen, which is my Japanese movie. I made a movie in Japan, 90% Japanese, 10% English. Yeah.
What's it called again?
It's called The Hammer. The hammer. The nail that sticks up must be hammered down. It's about the conspiracy in Japan of a mental hospital and conformity and things like that. It's a thriller, and I made it a while ago, but it's one of my favorite films. Anyway,
amazing. Yeah. Look, Doug, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And thank you, guys. Thank you.
And as always, don't forget to check out us on socials. You can check out the podcast at ross@anfieldtalkmovies.co.uk, and me and Ross are on all the socials. So thanks for listening. Thanks, Doug, for your time. It's been great. And we'll speak to you again, hopefully in the future. Take care.
Hope so. Bye-bye. Too. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you.